Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Fred Pfeiffer, and I know Fred through, you know, different things going on in the Capital District, and Fred is a union advocate, and he's here to talk about the importance of a union shop. Hi, Fred. How are you today?
Pretty good. I'm not complaining about the heat because it'll be cold soon enough.
The heat is the heat is really impressive. I'm looking forward to our first snowstorm, actually.
Definitely going to clear up tomorrow. But, you know, it's got a lot to do with climate change, I'm afraid. So that's one of the externalities that industry pours into the air. Anyway, I'm happy to be on your show. Thank you very much for inviting me. Maybe
Thank
I should
you.
Start and tell a little bit about my background.
Okay.
I grew up in New York State and ended up in Albany around 1974. And I got a job working at O.D. Heck, Eleanor Roosevelt Services. So that was my first union experience. I was in a CSEA local and became an officer, and we worked with the developmentally disabled and tried to establish good work rules so that we could do our jobs and treat the developmentally disabled with dignity, as well as make sure we were treated with dignity too. So from there, I actually left state service and went into industry and became a machinist. I was able to get into an apprentice program at General Electric. So I was able to see in like 1980 how industry operated in our country, and I was a member of the IUE 301 local there, so I was in an industrial union. So my experience was that if you were union, you had much better wages and benefits, and when the factory jobs started going south, I was laid off and worked in a number of other industrial union shops, most of which are all closed now in the Capital District, Tech Hughes and Waterville Lee, Campbell Plastics. So I experienced the outsourcing of jobs and saw how that brought down wages for machinists, particularly when I had to work in some non-union shops as a machinist. Fortunately, I was able to be hired because I took some labor management courses by a union, and I worked as a representative mostly for service workers. I worked for SEIU, Local 200D, and worked with janitors and private college workers as a representative, and also healthcare workers at the Albany VA. And I did organizing, nursing homes, and hospitals. So I had a pretty good extensive experience in the private sector, which is very rough and tumble. That's why there's such a low amount of union membership now in the private sector, because laws don't really help us organize and stay organized. And then I ended up working, helping to organize and get a contract for the graduate assistants at SUNY Albany, and went on to work for an AFSCME local and finally CSEA. So I also got a lot of experience in the public sector, which has a higher level of unionization, particularly in New York, but it's still woefully inadequate on a national scale. So this comprised probably about, from 1975 until I retired 3 or 4 years ago, 40 years of service, both as a worker, rank and filer in the union. I always participated, as well as a representative. So those 4 decades, and then sort of a bridge decade on either side of that, being an advocate and experiencing what it means to earn a living, has sort of given me, a fairly concrete basis to understand the world of work and what it means to be union and non-union.
So, you know, as I read the paper and I talk to people, I realize that the standard of living in this country is diminishing, and it's severely diminishing. So has union membership. From your knowledge, nationwide, what is the percentage of union membership in this country?
Well, I believe that in the public sector, it's 12% to 15%, and in the private sector, 7% to 10%, depending on what statistics you look at, including independent unions, and so on and so forth. And I agree with you that the as a result of the lower density of unionization, wages and benefits are declining, and I know why. Having a union is not a get-rich-quick scheme. Of course, we're always tempted to play the lottery and hope we get lucky and can get ahead on the whim of fate. But union is much more focused, and it starts with a concerted activity. In other words, your solidarity with your coworkers, finding injustice on the job, getting angry, and then trying to find a way to have courage to do something about it. And one of the best ways, if you're in an organizable situation, is to have union representation for a whole panoply of reasons. First, the economic reason. It's shown through the Bureau of Labor Statistics that union benefits are 30 union represented worksite benefits and wages are 30% to 40% over non-union sites in identical industries. So you might ask, well, how is that? You know, once you get the union out, they just move on over. Well, no, it's not that simple. Once you have a union, then you have a basis to negotiate in a collective fashion, which gives you a lot more strength than individual negotiation. And what you have is the ability to ask for information of the employer as to what the level of benefits are, what the wages are throughout the group that you've organized. So, in other words, employer tells you, oh, health insurance costs $15,000 a year for a family plan. So you can ask, well, I want to see how many people are now getting the family plan and how many people are getting the individual plan and how much that's costing you. So you may have said, well, there's 100 employees, and the employer is trying to say that they're spending $15,000 a year for health insurance for those 100 employees. So, you know, that's about $1 million. And then you find out that only 50% is getting the family and 25% is getting the individual, and other people have insurance elsewhere. So you do the math there and you say, oh, well, we just found, you said you're paying about, you know, $1.5 million on health insurance. We just found that you're not, because you're not covering everybody. So we just found $700,000. You know, let's negotiate around that and see what we can do with that money to improve people's health and access to health insurance. So that factor enables unions to get ahead 3% to 4% a year. In other words, you have a negotiation, you get 3%, 4%, 5% more in benefits and wages than anybody else, and lo and behold, within a 10-year period, because you've been getting that 3% to 4% bump a year, you're up to the Bureau of Labor Statistics 30% to 40% over non-union employees in the same industry. So that's how it works. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It gives you the foot in the door to get information and to negotiate in good faith at the bargaining table with an employer and to budget in the workers. And along with that comes some other benefit. Security of work, you're not able the boss, once you have a contract, generally you have a grievance procedure and a discipline clause, which only allows the employer to terminate you for just cause. And it's not just cause I want to. It's the type of just cause which requires proof that you did something that you shouldn't have done at work and you didn't listen to the orders of the boss or the work rules. There's a lot of ways the test can be applied as to whether it's a terminable offense. So it's sort of like if you get laid off or fired from a job and you feel it's unfair, you go to apply to unemployment, and unemployment uses those same tests to determine if your employer fired you justly or just wanted to get rid of you. And if it was an unjust firing, then you receive your unemployment. Well, it's the same way. You can retain your job if it's an unjust firing because of the grievance and discipline position. Procedure, and also sometimes get back wages and benefits while for the time that the unfair termination was litigated. So that's a nice advantage of union and being represented with a union contract. It also gives you freedom of speech and association at work, because if you organize the bargaining unit, that bargaining unit is a concept which determines what workers that you work with have the same commonality of interests, and that usually determines who's going to be in the union. So if you're in a service and maintenance group, you're going to see all those service and maintenance workers in all the different departments at your union meeting. So you start getting this cross-fertilization of ideas and acknowledgement and getting to know other workers, whereas if you rely on the boss's structure, you might not really know anybody outside of your own department. So that freedom of association is very valuable when it comes to using your solidarity at work for purposes of collective bargaining. And it also gives you freedom of speech. That means you can go to work and you can have your opinion and you're not going to be castigated because you have whatever your leanings are, you know, whether you're or you have some conservative leanings, you're not to be persecuted for expressing your Bill of Rights for freedom of speech. Once you go into work without a union, you really have no rights. When you punch in, it's what is called employment at will. And I've worked in situations where the only thing safe to talk about was the football pool or the current makeover on the Jerry Springer show, because everything was and could be used against you, because everybody was jockeying for position as individuals and the boss effectively kept everybody divided. And that is a terrible situation to be in at work, and it really is against our whole, I think, democratic concept of what we have under our democracy. So those are some of the benefits. You also get to meet other people. If you work within the union movement, you meet other people in your area in the same or other industries that are unionized, and you can talk to them worker to worker and develop more of a working class sensibility about who you are and what in the wider realm you might need to improve your lot in life, which, you know, one of the hot buttons now, of course, is access to health insurance and getting health insurance. With a union, you negotiate contract by contract health insurance, but what would be far superior to that would be to have universal coverage and only have enhanced insurance negotiations going on It would also save the employer money and put money aside perhaps for wages and other areas. So those are the good things about the union. But of course, you know, as you know, there's a lot of obstacles these days, right, Cynthia?
Mm-hmm. Yep. What are those obstacles?
Well, there's internal and external. External is the constructs of the labor law. It's sort of like, well, I have a right to, there ought to be a law. Well, it's not a Bill of Rights law that gives you as a worker the right representation on the job. In the Constitution says you have the right to amass wealth through hard work and thrift. But if you're under the thumb of a boss, that hard work could lead to starvation wages, no living wages, no pension. You could work your whole life and not get what we believe people are entitled to who do that. The labor law is based on basically interstate commerce, and to ensure that the open flow of interstate commerce. That's really what the National Labor Relations Act is based on, and that is the act which determines whether you can organize and remain organized as a union. But go ahead, what's your question?
My question is, and you brought up a very important point, in the private sector, people are losing their pensions at an astronomical, you know, rate. Okay, in the event when they retire, a lot of these people only have Social Security. I think our country is being impoverished. What do you do about the fact that very few people have pensions these days?
Well, you know, first of all, we have to fight to keep the Social Security system in place, as meager as it may be, okay? And that means more funding. And certainly one of the easiest ways to fund that is to take any of the caps off of people's earnings and make sure that their contribution to Social Security includes all their wages. I'm not really sure what the cap is now. I think it's around $3,000 a year wages, and after that you don't have to pay into Social Security. So that would enrich Social Security, and then with the corresponding Medicare payments, actually enable us to increase the payout as well as to increase the level of coverage and the amount of coverage for Medicare, because health insurance is one of the biggest costs for people as they get older. And as a result of the Sanders campaign, the Democratic Party actually adopted a plank to make Medicare people eligible for Medicare at age 55. Unfortunately, that was never widely reported in the campaign. And contrasting to that, the Republicans want to reduce Medicare, privatize it, as well as keep the wages stagnant. And as you can see right now, all the pundits would say, oh, take your Social Security right away at age 62, because that's going to give you the best economic benefit. And now the increasing mantra is, oh, wait till you're 70. Wait until you're 70, you'll get more money. But it will also save the system money, too. So it's a fierce battle, actually, or should be, to enhance Social Security. Because when it gets down to pensions, they're in jeopardy because basically of mismanagement of pension funds. And what I mean by that is when you're negotiating for a pension, rather than just negotiate for a matching amount in an IRA, which is just your basic fund, which is dependent upon market swings, to negotiate for something called a defined benefit plan, which guarantees you the levels of pension so that you can budget for when you you end up retiring. Unfortunately, a lot of these plans have been abused generally by the employer side of the table, because the employers look at the money they put into pensions for workers still somehow is their money rather than money that was negotiated and agreed to by both parties and oftentimes not paid out in wages or other benefits. So these defined benefit plans are run poorly. The amount of unionization has decreased, so there's not as many people paying into the plan, or the employer paying for them into the plan. So they start running deficits, being increasingly affected by market swings, and then ultimately less solvent. And all we have backing them up is the Pension Guarantee Act, which allows for the government to come in and help stabilize some of these pension funds, but it doesn't guarantee the payout at the level that the workers deserve. And one of the best safeguards for people who have defined benefit plans is to make sure that the union representation is equal to the employer representation in terms of the board that manages these funds. When it's dominated by the employer, you're going to see any possibility oftentimes of employers robbing back that money. You're going to see that happen. So that's one way to prevent it. And then the other way is to support your union in organizing and making sure that there's enough union members to keep the plan solvent, not only for you, but for future generations. But it's really hard because you have to be vigilant. And the people who are investing and trading and trying to get their hands on money for their own profit motive oftentimes fly in the face of what they've guaranteed for workers. So, right now it's a difficult time, and I think that there has to be increased regulation and better rules so that there's less obstacles in terms of union organization. And as I said, one of those obstacles is that the law is based on interstate commerce, not on absolute rights for workers. So what you have is a bureaucracy under most of these labor boards. And when I say boards, the major one is the National Labor Relations Board, but there's also the Federal Labor Relations Act Board. There's also the Public Employees Relations Board here in New York State, and in other states they have that depending on their employee law. So you have to have elected officials who appoint fair people onto these boards. And what we've seen with the current administration is they're putting increasingly business-oriented people on the board, conservatives, who are actually stripping some of the advances that we were able to proceed on at the labor board in terms of what is considered a bargaining unit, how long it takes you to get a union election, enforcement of the attempts of the boss to intimidate and divide people. Because the way a lot of employers look at it when the union comes knocking isn't what I would prefer. Oh, it's about time you employees got it together and came to me. Now we can, you can have some rights and we can negotiate something fair, and we'll have fair work rules that everybody respects, and I'll still have I'll still be able to make my profit margin within reason. Boss usually says, uh-oh, how dare they challenge me? I gave them this job. And they'll go and they'll say, well, geez, if their labor costs are $1 million a year, they know that if the union comes in, they're going to have 30% of that taken away because they're going to have to pay $300,000 over the 10 years, going back to the negotiation scenario I laid out. But I know an attorney, and if I pay him $100,000 to stop the union, then I'll be able to save $200,000. Boy, that's a business decision I can't resist. So they get legal advice and guidance to intimidate employees with one-on-one meetings, threatening to end any one-on-one negotiations that employees feel they've earned, basically divide and conquer, and point out differences between employees. One recent one was the organizing of the nurses at Albany Med, which was successful, and that's awesome. But they resorted even to sending a letter out to some of the immigrant nurses, trying to scare them about their status if the union came in. And that was a very mean-spirited thing for Albany Medical Center to do, break the law at times, employers. And they'll even look at, well, if I'm guilty, how much will it cost me? And if that's less than what they think they're going to lose by unionization, they will break the law. And so the law does not have consequences that are strong enough to avoid that. And the workers allow themselves to be divided because, once again, when you see injustice, you should get angry. That's the first step. But the second step is a little harder. You have to muster the courage and take the time to do something about it. And when the workers do that, they generally win. And when they allow the boss to divide them and conquer them, generally lose and go back to their old ways of individual negotiation, which leads to manipulation and inequity at the work site. So those are some of the problems in there. Again, that's why there's less unionization, and that will lead to lower pensions and basically stripping workers of many of their wages and benefits. I mean, one of the things we've tried to do as a movement is fight for living wages. The current federal wage, I believe, is $7.50 an hour, and in New York City it's $15, and in the upstate it's getting up to that level, $15 an hour. So it's like double what the national is, and we've done that through activists and unions getting together. But the missing piece of that, I'm afraid, is that unless people really are in a union, they don't get that. They think that the elected officials, by their own good graces, convince the bosses to pay them more, and that's all that they need. And they're sadly mistaken, because it's not just the wages. All the other issues of being a union are important drivers of the process. And frankly, workers, as bad as the employers are in dividing, conquering, and intimidating, workers need to stand up more and realize that they have some power. And it can't happen. I've been involved in campaigns, the Albany Public Library. I worked on a campaign for the crossing guards to get organized in my retirement because I was so angry at how they were treated here in Albany. And I've also organized the Julie Blair Nursing Home, now at the Hudson Heights Nursing Home. So I've done quite a bit of organizing in the area, and I've seen workers, when they stand up, winning campaigns. And that's because the workers allow themselves to be intimidated and discouraged. So a lot of it is up to the workers. But once again, it's a daunting task because the laws are not up to the task of preventing people and encouraging them to do it. And really the reason we have labor laws and there was an encouragement for unionization is because a better distribution of wealth creates a better economy. And without the mechanisms of people standing up and getting better wages and benefits, we're not going to get that distribution. It's going to be a dole, little by little, by the people at the top who have some sensibilities, trying to be industrialists to do what they should do. But I think that brings me to one point that I really want to talk about in terms of sort of looking at our society. Although when you get a union, you have these benefits and these freedoms. The one freedom that we do not have, and some of the unions are trying to move in that direction, is we don't have the freedom of deciding what the work is, and we don't have the freedom or any legal protections to tell the boss this is how they want to do our work. We can bring up issues with labor management, but it's really up to the boss to run the works, and they usually run it in a way to get the best profit, even if they pollute, even if they have a high turnover. We don't get to talk about technologically what we're jobs right now is getting into the water of the lead arsenal, right, and making the tubes for the tanks and the Navy guns. And there's not much of if any, sentiment saying, well, we have this great industrial facility over here. What can we do to convert away from a wartime economy into a peacetime economy? Workers don't have the right to call those shots. And that's one of the big liabilities of how we run labor law in this country. We don't have that right. We're controlled by the boss, and they decide, even if it means disaster for our environment, for what people want to buy and consume, promoting empire, we don't have a right to challenge that through our work organizations. We have to do that in the public sector. And really, it's archaic. It goes back to the divine right of kings and British management has total control over their investment. And that's a problem. I see that the nurses, once again, are trying to fight for better staffing. And once again, that's not necessarily an issue that they can bargain over, but they're going public and they're arousing the public for safe practices in hospitals and winning some of those battles. But they're very difficult.
Okay, we covered a lot this morning, so let's plan to do something else. And I look forward to seeing you at the labor picnic on Monday. So why don't you give a little plug for the labor picnic?
Okay, I'm one of a group of charter members of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District, which we started during the Greyhound strike in 1983, and we went on and promoted more aggressive tactics on the picket line in order to win justice for workers in the aftermath of PATCO and the union busting of the Reagan administration. What we've been doing consistently since 35 years now is having Labor Day, on Labor Day, celebrations and picnics and parades. So this year, this will be our 35th Labor Day celebration. We're at Cook Park in the Village of Colony from noon to 4:30. Our activists get together, and we provide hamburgers, hot dogs, veggie burgers, beverages. We ask people to bring a potluck dish to join in the celebration. We have short speeches. We give out awards to people who and organizations that have done good work in the field of worker advocacy, human rights, and the environment. So that's from 12 to 4:30. There'll be music. It's a family affair. I think that there's only a small percentage possibility of showers, so we're in an indoor canopied area anyway. But we also have a lot of picnic tables on the outskirts. So it should be an excellent day to get together and network. A lot of groups come and table and share information. So It's something that we like to do every year, and we do it, so we're looking forward to people showing up. If you want to come early and help set up or stay late and help clean up, we like that too. It's a community event for everybody, and we just ask people to pitch in whatever way they can and come to the event. There will also be a silent auction of union memorabilia and raffles to help us pay for the picnic supplies. So bring a little extra change. I think you won't be disappointed.
Great. So I look forward to
sorry.
I look forward to seeing you on Monday, Fred. So you've been listening
yes.
to Fred Pfeiffer on Focus on Albany. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany. Thanks, Fred. I look forward to speaking with you again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great
okay.
day. Bye.
Thank you. Ciao.